Testing, testing, okay.
All right, good afternoon. We want to welcome everybody today, January 25th, 2018, room 643 in the LOB. This is the Joint Legislative Oversight Committee on Justice and Public Safety. A little housekeeping, our House Sergeant of Arms today are Reggie Seals, Marvin Lee, Thomas Terry, the Senate, Billy Fitzer, and Linda Matthews. Thank you all for being here. And also want to recognize our staff that's here today. Thank you all. And today, if I can get the approval of the minutes, I have a motion. Representative Turner from Iredale. All opposed? Thank you. Today, we're having a presentation from the Secretary Eric Hooks from the Department of Public Safety. But before he speaks, I would like to have opening remarks or comments from our chairs if they would like to say anything. Okay, thank you. All right. At this point in time, we've elected to bump the State Highway Patrol Rapid Response Team to another date, and so we will proceed on into our committee meeting today. But before we get into our committee meeting, I'll just remind everybody this is a joint oversight committee that the department is giving a presentation to the chamber. At this point in time, and today we will not take public comments from the public, but I'm going to recognize Mr. John Poteet from our staff. We have made a website that you're able to submit comments, and we will get back with you. And I would like to recognize staff at this point in time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee and the public at large, on the Justice and Public Safety Oversight Committee webpage, there is a link called Request for Comments, and there's a form that interested parties can fill out and submit comments and questions that they have, and those will be going to all members of the Oversight Committee.
Okay, does anybody need that repeated? All right, at this point in time, I would like to recognize everybody in the room, but I will get in trouble that way. But I would especially like to recognize we have our Secretary Eric Hooks, Director of SBI, Mr. Schumacher, our General Lux is here, and also the ALE Director, Mr. Terry Weather, he is also with us, Mary Weather. At this point in time, Secretary, if you'd like to have opening remarks. And we ask that all questions will be answered or will be asked after the presentation, okay?
Again, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the Justice and Public Safety Oversight Committee. We're here today to discuss how we can improve the safety and security of our prisons, implement best practices for prison operations, mitigate the inherent dangers, and enhance the working environment for our criminal justice professionals who serve in our facilities. We owe it to the public and to our employees to keep state prisons secure. And we owe it to our fallen employees and their families to do all we can to prevent a similar tragedy from ever happening again. As you're aware, I came into the role of Secretary in January of 2017. And just as I did in 1989, when I started as an SBI agent, I took an oath to faithfully discharge the duties of my office and to support and defend the Constitution of this state, as well as the Constitution of our country. This remains my solemn duty to this day. This duty transcends all personal preferences and politics. We are all deeply affected by the two tragic incidents in our prison facilities. No words will adequately express the grief the families and friends and co-workers have experienced during this past year. I, like many of our employees, have spoken with, prayed for and with, and wept for the families most affected by these incidents. Beyond our grief, we have seen a resolve by families, co-workers, prisons administration, this department, the governor, and the legislature to bring about substantive change. Problems faced by prisons are not unique to North Carolina and did not begin in 2017. However, I'm not here to make excuses. We're here to outline real solutions, actions we have implemented, and to take suggestions as we work collaboratively on this important issue. DPS nor one individual can solve the issues alone, and I welcome the oversight this body offers to the process of improvement. I have been forthright with the committee chairs and the governor, and I expect that dialogue will continue. In some public venues, my concerns about compromising five criminal trials has been inappropriately cast as a desire to hide behind secrecy. This is simply not true. We have publicly shared the Governor's Crime Commission report. I have clearly indicated that public information from the National Institute of Corrections report will be shared accordingly. However, I do not think it is appropriate to undermine, by public commentary, the prosecution of two district attorneys who are seeking justice for the families and society as a whole. Likewise, the General Assembly and the courts have consistently recognized that safety and security information is not a matter of public record, and I have abided by the law in this regard. Policy decisions aimed at managing the growing population and reducing the number of offenders with misdemeanor and probation violations in North Carolina prisons have resulted in an inmate population with a higher concentration of volatile and potentially violent offenders. The challenging task of supervising this more dangerous population while ensuring the safety of all staff and inmates requires a renewed focus on safety and security. In 2011, the General Assembly passed the Justice Reinvestment Act. This act made several key changes to sentencing policy to reduce admissions to prisons and increase accountability in the community with probationers. One significant change in the act was to redirect all misdemeanants into county custody. This reduction in the prison population meant that the lower risk inmates were moved out and the population in state prisons became more concentrated into a group of violent repeat offenders. In 1997, the percentage of Class A through E felons in prisons was 38%. As of June 2017, 68% of the prison population was Class A through E felons. The present sentencing structure was enacted to reserve prison for the most aggressive, high-risk offenders coming through the courts and to hold lower-risk offenders accountable in the community. The current inmate population, made up of those convicted of violent crimes and those who continue to break the law habitually, is the intended result of two decades of sentencing policy choices. In addition, the prison population is currently seeing a higher number of inmates diagnosed with and requiring treatment for mental health issues. The number of inmates diagnosed and treated for mental illness has increased 65% in the last 10 years. As you are aware, ensuring the safety of our employees, visitors, and inmates within our prison facilities is my top priority for the Division of Adult Corrections and Juvenile Justice. During my first year, I conducted site visits, met with prison staff at all levels, individually, and through staff meetings, and solicited employee feedback on ways to enhance safety and improve operations at prisons facilities and to identify ways to retain staff. During the first quarter of 2017, we were engaged in discussions about vacancies and hiring rate, as well as corrupt activity within prisons. I actively sought to improve intelligence sharing from the Division of Adult Corrections with our law enforcement entities. I sought out the support of district attorneys and federal prosecutors to encourage prosecution and cooperation. On April 26, at approximately 5:30 p.m., Sergeant Megan Lee Callahan was assaulted. She was responding to a trash can fire in a dormitory at Bertie Correctional Institution. After responding to the fire, Sergeant Callahan was attacked by inmate Craig Wissink. Sergeant Callahan sustained injuries from the attack, which led to her death. Wissink has been charged with first-degree murder. A criminal investigation was conducted by the State Bureau of Investigation and the Windsor Police Department. The prosecution of that case is in the purview of District Attorney Valerie Asbell. The division has cooperated fully with the law enforcement investigation and the Office of Special Investigations, OSI, which has completed its internal investigation. The OSI investigation is under review. North Carolina Department of Labor conducted an independent investigation to determine compliance with workplace safety laws. No citations were issued at the conclusion of this investigation. In May 2017, we began attacking the backlog in training to ensure no officer is assigned to a post prior to receiving basic correctional officer training. We determined a need to have a nationwide review of best practices. On June 14, 2017, I requested the Governor's Crime Commission, the GCC, to complete a national review of best practices in prison management with a focus on hiring practices for correctional officers, training, staffing at prison facilities, security procedures to interdict contraband, and measures to detect and address staff misconduct. The Governor's Crime Commission engaged Duke University Sanford School of Public Policy to complete the review. The report was presented to DPS late on December 7, 2017, and was provided to the General Assembly and the public on December 8, 2017. Over the summer and early fall, we were very focused on increasing hiring, training officers before being placed on a post, reducing contraband, and assessing security needs. In October, four prison employees died, and several others were hospitalized during an attempted prison escape at Pasquotank Correctional Institution. Officers Justin Smith and Wendy Shannon, Correction Enterprises Supervisor Veronica Darden, and maintenance employee Jeffrey Howe died as a result of the actions of four inmates. The attempted escape occurred on October 12th around 3 p.m. Inmates started a fire in the facility's specialty sewing plant, where about 30 inmates worked producing logo items, safety vests, and other sewn items. After the fire was set, the four inmates unsuccessfully attempted to escape. Indictments have been handed down against 28-year-old Mikhail Brady, 29-year-old Wiseman Buckman, 33-year-old Seth Frazier, and 30-year-old Jonathan Monk, charging each with four counts of first-degree murder, five counts of assault with a deadly weapon, along with several other charges, including attempted escape. A criminal investigation was conducted by the State Bureau of Investigation and the Pasquotank County Sheriff's Office. The prosecution of that case is in the purview of District Attorney Andrew Womble. The division has cooperated fully with the law enforcement investigation. The internal investigation conducted by the Office of Special Investigations is ongoing. The North Carolina Department of Labor is conducting an independent investigation to determine compliance with workplace safety laws. Immediately after the tragic events in Pasquotank, the following occurred. Pasquotank Correctional Institution was locked down, restricting movement of all inmates and suspending all programmatic activities. Pasquotank Correctional Institution sewing plant was permanently shut down. I ordered the removal of more than 250 offenders who fit a specific profile of convictions for assaultive crimes from participation in correction enterprises operations across the state that involved the use of cutting and or impact tools until further risk assessments could be completed. I implemented a new policy prohibiting those with convictions of violent crime against a government official or a law enforcement officer from being assigned to any workstation utilizing or providing access to cutting or impact tools without the expressed approval of the Director of Prisons. We increased the number of correctional officers providing security in correction enterprise areas and increased the number of rounds by the officer in charge within those areas until such time as a full security review is conducted. On October 20th, 2017, 8 days after the tragedy at Pasquotank Correctional Institution, I requested the Division of the National Institute of Corrections, NIC, to conduct an independent review of all safety and security operations at Pasquotank Correctional Institution to include the adjacent sewing plants. On Friday, January the 9th, I received the final NIC 78-page security operational assessment, which includes recommendations and observations. My staff and I have been reviewing these recommendations to formulate further action plans. There are a number of things that are troubling, ranging from staffing, policy guidance, tool control, communication, and complacency. And we take the full report very seriously. We appreciate the very in-depth review and the comprehensive list of recommendations provided by the NIC in the report. There is still much work to be done to make our prison safer. In addition to the dozens of actions already completed or underway, and we welcome continued help from the NIC. Our prison safety reform initiatives have been focused on four primary areas, which include enhancing overall security policies and practices, increasing hiring and retention, improving training for new and veteran employees, and reducing contraband in our facilities. At this time, Mr. Chairman, I would like to recognize Chief Deputy Secretary Pam Cashwell to provide a more detailed overview of the steps that have been taken in the last year. This PowerPoint presentation will highlight the measures completed, measures in ongoing or pending status, and the next steps to be taken.
Ms. Cashwell. Welcome.
Do we think it's going to work? Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the Committee on Justice and Public Safety, again, I'm Pam Cashwell. I'm one of the Chief Deputy Secretaries at the North Carolina Department of Public Safety. As Secretary Hooks noted, our initiatives to improve public safety fall into four main categories. First, enhancing security policies and practices. Second, increasing hiring and retention. Third, improving training for new and veteran employees. And finally, reducing contraband in prison facilities. I will provide a broad overview of the key projects we have completed, significant initiatives that are ongoing or pending, and end with a few of our next steps. However, before outlining these efforts, I think it's important to again briefly mention the assistance we've sought in the two reports we've received. Excuse me. As the Secretary noted, in June of last year, We requested the Governor's Crime Commission, which I will hereafter refer to as the GCC, to research best practices nationwide in several areas of prison management and provide recommendations to the Secretary. That report makes 17 recommendations, the essence of which suggests that we need to make an investment in our people by incentivizing a commitment to corrections as a career, bringing more resources and attention to recruitment, modernizing our training, utilizing more and better communication tools, and improving facility safety. We have begun addressing some of their specific recommendations already, and many will likely couple with the recommendations we recently received from the NIC, or the National Institute of Corrections. Again, as the Secretary noted, immediately following the tragedy at Pasquotank Correctional Institution, he requested the National Institute of Corrections to conduct an independent and comprehensive review of the safety and security operations at Pasquotank, as well as all aspects of correctional enterprises, operations, and safety protocols. In early November of last year, a six-member security assessment team came to North Carolina for a week, conducting an intensive review of the sewing plant at Pasquotank and two other correctional enterprise operations located at the Nash Correctional Institution. Those were a print plant and an optical plant. As noted by Secretary Hooks, we received the NIC's report late Friday and are in the process of digesting the recommendations and accompanying observations. Both the GCC report and the NIC report provide support for the initiatives we've already started and will help guide and direct our future efforts to enhance prison safety. With that background, I'd like to start discussing the actions we've taken already, beginning with enhancing security policies and practices. In response to concerns raised by staff at all levels, we revised the offender disciplinary policy and procedures effective January 3rd of this year. These changes strengthen the policy by upgrading certain charges to a higher level and thus will hold inmates more accountable for rules violations and discourage violent behavior. This action is supported by the NIC report. We have also fostered partnerships with law enforcement to help encourage charges and prosecutions against inmates and, when necessary, staff for criminal activity. Specifically, over the spring and summer, we met with the three North Carolina U.S. Attorney's offices, the Conference of DAs, and various law enforcement agencies to develop stronger partnerships with our prisons managers. These meetings are already paying dividends. We have also improved our departmental and criminal intelligence gathering and utilization to address criminal activity within prisons. We did so by increasing the staff within the department's intelligence unit to better manage and facilitate intelligence gathering, and by enhancing the partnerships for sharing that intelligence information between our internal and external stakeholders, like the SBI's Isaac Fusion Center. This was a recommendation in the GCC report that, gratefully, we had already started working on last summer. Last fall, prisons established an interagency advisory committee on technology related to prison safety. This group is comprised of DPS staff from across multiple agencies, to include prisons operations, adult corrections, special operations and intelligence, our general counsel's office, the State Highway Patrol, and emergency management. The committee will consider and recommend additional technology and individual devices to enhance security of our prisons and correction enterprises, staff, facilities, and plant operations. The committee has researched the use of tasers and recommended a pilot to add tasers to the safety packages of certain designated personnel at close custody facilities. We purchased and deployed batons last year to fully equip correctional officers at our medium custody facilities. Previously, only close custody officers carried batons, and this was a safety concern raised by our medium custody staff. Moving to actions that are ongoing or pending. After the NIC's on-site visits to audit the Correction Enterprises operations, the Director of Prisons ordered safety and security audits of the remaining Correction Enterprises operations. Those reviews are ongoing by independent external reviewers. They have completed security audits at 8 Correction Enterprises plants, and for most of those plants, corrective actions are in motion or have been completed. Importantly, most all of the corrective actions recommended by the NIC at the 2 plants located at Nash have been completed even prior to our receiving the report on Friday. As the Secretary noted, the sewing plant at Pascal Tank is no longer in operation. Late last year, the Director of Prisons also created a security accountability unit within prisons that will help develop new safety audit training policies and procedures and ensure regular and comprehensive safety audits occur at all of our prison facilities. This need is supported by the NIC report. Prisons is currently working with the NIC to identify best practices and create a security audit protocol for that unit. Four people from the National Institute of Corrections will again come from the NIC as part of a security assessment team and be here for a week in late February to train 24 of our security audit staff to conduct these comprehensive security reviews. As part of that training, they will audit 3 more of our prison facilities. The Secretary also directed our Emergency Management Division to work with prisons to integrate the floor plans of the state's 55 prison facilities into the State Emergency Response Application known as CERA. CERA is a secure web-based application that, when fully integrated, will provide prison profile and process information as well as spatially display prison floor plans, key assets, and vulnerabilities to our first responders. This information can be crucial for first responders in an emergency situation. Other measures that are ongoing. We have directed prison staff to conduct a comprehensive review and update of all prison and correction enterprises policies and procedures. This process began in November and is one of the predominant recommendations in the NIC report. We have also requested the National Institute of Corrections to assist us in reviewing and revalidating our inmate classification protocols. What we learned is that our classification tools utilized to assess offenders as they enter the prison system have not been revised to recognize, as the Secretary mentioned, that our inmate population has significantly changed over the last 10 years. The NIC gratefully agreed to work with a team of prison staff to conduct a 9-month critical assessment and revalidation of those protocols, and that process begins this month. In the aftermath of the Pascal Tank tragedy, the Secretary also ordered a review of the inmate assessment policies utilized to assign offenders to correction enterprises jobs and other work assignments within prisons, and specifically ask the NIC to review those policies and offer assistance as part of their security audits. These next few items are more directly related to personal safety and site security. First, we've ordered stab-resistant undershirts for all of our 13,000 certified employees. For clarification, a certified employee is one who is certified by the Criminal Justice Training and Standards Commission to work as a correctional officer. Those employees are required to attend basic correctional officer training. It includes many of our programs staff, not just correctional officers. These shirts will add an extra level of safety and confidence for our staff who deal with a population who may have a propensity for violence. Last year, prisons also developed a long-range strategic plan for video camera upgrades. While we replace our broken and outdated cameras annually, monitors as well, this plan includes upgrading, purchasing, and installing additional and replacement cameras and monitors in all facilities and would significantly expedite the current upgrade and installation process. The need for additional cameras was noted in the NIC report, and we will seek funding to accomplish this task in 2018. We have also developed a plan to provide personal body alarm technology to all prison employees through lanyards and radio device upgrades. Lanyards are a life alert style device, either worn around the neck or at the waist, and would be provided to all prison staff, not just certified staff, as well as official visitors to include volunteers in our prisons. The personal alarm technology sends notification and location information in critical situations. The NIC report identified this technology as the single most important piece of personal safety equipment that can be issued to all staff and volunteers working in a correctional facility, and we will seek immediate funding to implement this action item. This plan also provides, are you up with me? I'm not even paying attention to whether my slides are with me. Okay, great, thanks. This plan also provides an expedited schedule for upgrading our radio technology to fully utilize its capabilities with text messaging, man down, and fall emergency features. Similar to cameras, we conduct annual upgrades and replacements of our radio technology, and we are currently deploying radios as they are broken or need replacement. However, this would expedite that process and would require significant technology infrastructure improvements within our facilities. Again, we will seek funding to accomplish this task. Turning our attention to hiring and retention, it is no secret that vacancy rates in prisons is a national problem and has been one in North Carolina for years. The issue is twofold. First, in some of our more rural parts of the state, it is very difficult to hire people into correctional officer positions. But the real problem is that retention is an issue everywhere in our state. For example, in 2016, prisons hired about 75 correctional officers per month, but lost 150 per month to attrition. With an increase last year to our recruitment efforts and some improvements to our hiring process, we increased that average hiring rate to 147 per month, but we still lost that same 150 per month on average. Thus, while our hiring increased, staff continued to leave at the same rate, with the net effect that our vacancy rate has basically remained flat. People, of course, leave for a variety of reasons, and morale is certainly one of them, but it is clear that retention is a serious issue, and we cannot hire our way out of this understaffing problem in North Carolina. As noted previously, we've reached out to employees to better understand why they leave and what we can do to retain them. We also have the results of a study by East Carolina University, as well as the GCC's recommendations aimed at retention, and will work to implement those recommendations in 2018. To bring you up to speed on our current efforts that we have completed and are ongoing regarding hiring and retention, program staff, who I mentioned earlier, many are certified employees, were not included in the recent study for correctional officers and did not include salary increases. Those staff are involved in inmate counts and other supervisory tasks, and we heard about this disparity and its effect on morale for our employees as we crossed the state meeting with individuals. Late last year, we addressed this salary disparity through an in-range salary adjustment for our program staff. We also identified that military veterans are a key population that we are not fully utilizing, and late last year hired a full-time military recruiter to work with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs and our North Carolina National Guard to increase our recruitment and hiring of military veterans to work as correctional officers. We hope to start seeing the fruits of his labor very soon. Communication is a major issue in prisons and was highlighted in the Governor's Crime Commission report. Approximately 9,000 correctional officers do not have access to a work email. To improve communication channels to those employees, we have developed a plan to provide email accounts to those who currently do not have access. And while I noted that we have made improvements to the hiring process, there is much more to be done. We are working with the Office of State Human Resources to conduct a comprehensive review of the current, frankly still cumbersome, hiring process to make it more efficient and customer friendly. As Secretary Hooks noted, early last spring, training was identified as an important area for reform in prisons. With several major initiatives at play, we have made some great strides with some aspects of training for correctional officers, but there is certainly more to do. First, we have ensured that all new employees attend basic training prior to being assigned to a post. Starting in late July, we required newly hired officers to begin attending basic correctional officer training on their second week on the job, following 1 week of orientation at their work location. Last spring, there were more than 700 correctional officers on post who had not attended basic training. The Secretary directed prisons to work with our Office of Staff Development and Training to eliminate that backlog of officers as quickly as possible. Through the nearly heroic efforts of our Office of Staff Development and Training and our prison staff, the backlog has dropped from more than 700 to approximately 120, with all remaining officers who are currently assigned to a post now scheduled to be trained by March of this year. In 2017, seems silly. This is important. I'm sorry. In 2017, 2,081 officers attended basic correctional officer training, up from 1,530. It was a major task for our staff to accomplish, and they did a monumental job with it, identifying every place possible with their staff working crazy hours away from their families to provide these basic correctional officer programs. So forgive me if I get emotional about it. I appreciate so much what our staff has done to address these issues in prisons over the last year. Okay. In the aftermath of Pasquotank, we also realized the need to provide situational awareness training to officers, correctional enterprise staff, healthcare, and other non-certified staff. This training addresses, among other things, factors to be aware of when responding to an emergency, personal safety, and just simply being aware of your surroundings. The need for additional training of this sort is also highlighted in the National Institute of Corrections report. To address this issue, our Office of Staff Development and Training has developed the curriculum for 2 hours of situational awareness training as part of our BCO, and that became effective basic correctional officer training, and that was deployed this month with our new classes. In addition, they developed 4 hours of in-service training, and that is being deployed early this year to our non-certified staff. 31 of 55, which we have 55 prisons, 31 of our 55 superintendents are eligible for retirement in 2018. We have to cultivate leaders and do it quickly. We recognize the need for developing leadership staff within prisons, as well as providing educational pathways to promotion. To address this issue, we have met with the leadership at the community college system to discuss ways to further collaborate in the delivery of training for new hires and managers. Our Office of Staff Development and Training is also working with Wake Tech to develop a new online supervisory training module. During town hall meetings, those within prison leadership, during town hall meetings with staff as well as meetings with prison leadership at all levels, we received significant feedback regarding the need for hands-on training and mentoring for our new hires. Thus, we are implementing a new field training officer program modeled after a previous mentoring program that prisons used to have in place and incorporating elements of the current career readiness program. Training for those field training officers begins on March 1st of this year, and the GCC report supports that action. Turning to contraband. Contraband in the form of cell phones, shanks, drugs, and other illegal items is a persistent and, again, a national issue in prisons. Contraband comes in a number of ways. By our visitors, throwovers, the mail, by our staff, some of our staff, and even drones on occasion. In the spring of 2017, we began focusing on several initiatives to enhance our efforts at reducing contraband, many of which were referenced in the GCC report. First, we addressed our prison's entry and exit points by enhancing the prison entry-exit policy, making it mandatory for every person who enters most of our prisons to undergo a pat frisk search. This policy became effective in mid-October of last year and is designed to discourage and prevent contraband from entering our facilities. We also purchased and installed more cell sense towers to fully equip every prison facility with this cell phone detection equipment. These are mobile units. We call them towers, but they're about this big and about 6 feet tall, and an individual stands in front of them and turns around. They are aimed at preventing the entry of cell phones, but also can detect certain metals that may be found in other items that could be used as a weapon within our prisons. We also requested prison perimeter patrols by the State Highway Patrol when a trooper is in the area of a facility. These are aimed at preventing throwovers of contraband. Some ongoing and pending initiatives in the area of contraband include: we have contracted with a vendor to install managed access system equipment in 2018 at two of our close custody prisons. Managed access is a radio frequency technology that is deployed within a facility perimeter in the building locations, housing areas, etc., to detect, intercept, and block the use of unauthorized cell phones. This disrupts the use of cell phones for unauthorized calls, texts, and data transmissions to the outside of the facility. So while the cell sense towers are designed to identify if you have a cell phone on you, the managed access technology is to prevent one from being able to utilize a cell phone in the facility. This technology also includes drone detection alerts and provides notice of incoming drone activity. We began the process, prisons began the process of planning and installing additional perimeter fencing. This additional fencing is designed to increase the perimeter from the exterior to the interior, basically provide another layer and push people away from the facility. At some facilities, prisons is also eliminating trees and bushes where someone can hide in order to throw over contraband. Those are the initiatives we have completed or are working on, and now I will review a few of our next steps to further strengthen prison security. First, we are establishing a prison reform advisory board consisting of experts in the field of corrections. These prison experts will be external to DPS, who will provide ongoing advice on the best practices for maintaining prison security. We will also appoint a primary lead to ensure that all these prison reform initiatives and there are many, are achieved in a timely, cost-effective, and efficient manner. This person will work with the Prison Reform Advisory Board, adult corrections and juvenile justice leadership, employees at all levels of the agency, the Office of Staff, Budget, and Management, fiscal research staff, as well as external stakeholders. Again, we must improve our internal and external communications with respect to prison's operations. To do so, in addition to providing the email access that I mentioned earlier, our communications office is developing a plan that will utilize various other tools to get key and critical information to our prison staff quickly, and also to ensure that we provide consistent and timely responses to requests for information by our internal and external stakeholders. The State Employees Association of North Carolina represents 8,900 correctional officers. Thus, we have met with the leadership of SENIC to foster better communication with our correctional staff. Regarding recruitment and retention, in order to recruit and retain officers, we must develop a marketing strategy and update our correctional officer recruitment materials. The GCC report noted that our recruitment materials are outdated. In addition, we've met with the community college system leadership to explore opportunities for recruiting community college students by creating pathways to a correctional profession and participating in community college job fairs. In the area of training, as recommended by the GCC report, our Office of Staff Development and Training will conduct a comprehensive review of our current basic correctional officer training program to determine where adjustments should be made. Also, recognizing the need to provide better training for our new and current supervisors, the Office of Staff Training and Development will also conduct a comprehensive review of our in-service training for supervisors. We will continue to review the Governor's Crime Commission report as well as the NIC report to further outline a strategic plan for additional immediate needs and items to be implemented over time. Finally, we will engage the members of this committee and the full General Assembly to address immediate safety and security equipment needs as well as policy changes. We will also engage the General Assembly to address hiring and retention concerns to include salary, hiring incentives, and other retention needs. We are exploring a number of options to address salary disparities and compression issues, as well as hiring incentives like sign-on and referral bonuses, which were recommended by the GCC report. With that, I would like to turn it back over to the Secretary for closing remarks and then questions. Thank you very much.
In conclusion, prisons are dangerous places, and the problems within them did not happen overnight. It will take a concerted effort by our department and this body to make our prisons safer. In reviewing the makeup of the inmate population, the incidents that occurred in April and October, and the prison's workforce, it is evident the prison system is facing many issues. As I've said countless times, the safety of our employees, visitors, and inmates within prison facilities is my top priority for the division. Increasing safety and security will require a substantial financial investment, and I look forward to working with you to accomplish this important mission. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. At this point in time, we'll open it up for questions, and I'll ask that the questions will be direct and pertain to this presentation, and the Secretary has many of his staff here that could answer and support, but also he also has informed me that there's some questions he may not be able to answer because of the ongoing litigation. So it's nothing that he didn't want to answer, but there's some things that we'll not be able to at this point in time. I recognize Chairman Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Secretary Hooks, there was made mention in the presentation.
I got it right here.
of the National Institute of Corrections review that y'all have received, and I believe y'all are looking at it right now. My question would be, when will this review be made available to the co-chairs of this committee, the members of this committee, as well as the public?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chairman. Our anticipated rollout of that review, the NIC review, should be made available to you today. And within the next few hours, I do expect that the chairs, the members of the General Assembly, as well as the public, will be able to have that.
Follow up. Could you please tell us how we would have access to that report?
All right. Could I please recognize Chief Deputy Secretary Cassandra Hoekstra, who's going to coordinate that for us?
Thank you, Chairman. Cassandra Hoekstra, Chief Deputy for Administration with the Department of Public Safety. Our plan is to provide that document to you electronically through your email accounts. Can you hear me now? Okay. If that is not workable, then we are certainly open to other options. But given the length of the report, we thought that the best option.
If you could, I understand that would apply to the committee co-chairs as well as the committee members. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. That is correct.
What about the public?
The report will be made available publicly this afternoon at 4 o'clock. It'll be available on our website.
Thank you.
And I have Chairman Randleman.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Caught me a little off guard. I would like to question on slide 6. It makes reference to a revised offender disciplinary policy procedure that went into effect on January the 3rd. Can you be a little bit more detailed about what the new policy is and how it compared with the old policy?
Yes, Madam Chair, if you would allow me to recognize our Prisons Director, Kenneth Lassiter, to answer that for you.
Kenneth Lassiter, Director of Prison. Madam Chair, the old disciplinary policy, or the policy that came into play, we corrected some things that we had changed due to some collaboration with the VIRA Institute and a couple more outside stakeholders this past year. In doing that, it had an adverse effect on a couple of disciplinary charges. We had charges that range from A to D in a class, and we eliminated the class D offense. In doing that, that had an adverse effect on the sanctions that could be placed on an offender. And so the new policy corrected those adverse effect and actually moved a couple of charges higher up on the scale of what the inmate could receive based on feedback from our staff. One of those being disrespect or disobeying orders, which used to be a C charge, was actually elevated in this new policy to a B charge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So your A through D's make reference to the actual action from the inmate, whatever the offense is that the inmate commits. So you're saying that you have elevated some of those offenses. And I think you have also presented maybe some possible legislation that may address some of those offenses as well.
Yes, ma'am. Some of the things we got from the best practice from across the country was that our female staff, who's some of our greatest staff, should not have to come to work and watch a man expose himself, masturbate, sex acts, and only the inmate receive 30 days in restrictive housing. We pride ourselves on being the first state in a lot of things, but we're behind the eight ball. A couple of states have already changed the law and made it a criminal offense, therefore a sex crime, therefore inmates can receive additional sentence time, which the evidence showed reduced the number of acts performed by inmates.
Thank you.
I have Senator Steinberg and Charles Graham after Steinberg. Representative Steinberg, go ahead.
Not Senator yet, sir. Thank you. Yes, sir. Secretary Hooks, thank you for being here and for the presentation. It appears as though a lot of work went into this presentation. I did notice that there was one issue that really was not addressed, and this seems to be, at least to me, the seminal issue of what is going on in our prisons today. I want you to just take a look here on my desk at the correspondence that I've received from people throughout the Department of Corrections, both staff, correction officers, as well as inmates. And there seems to be a theme, even though these are from all across the state, there seems to be a theme that comes through loud and clear. And Ms. Cashwell addressed it in her remarks when she said morale is a huge problem. Well, that's what I'm reading in all of these pieces of correspondence here and other pieces of correspondence I've had and telephone calls and texts and so on and so forth. That seems to be it. Now, what I would like to ask you, sir, is number one, do you recognize this is a problem yourself? And can you elaborate as to why within your ranks there seems to be a lot of dissension? There is no trust anymore in management, both in Raleigh and also, and these are not my words, these are the words of these folks right here, in Raleigh as well as within many of these institutions. So could you, I mean, are you aware of this, number one, and are you sensing this? You know, I was the one that had mentioned publicly about this secret society, and I know that you and others took exception to that. Well, it's a secret society if there is what's going on in the prisons we don't know anything about.
Representative, can you answer your question?
I'm going to give him, I'm going to piggyback, and you can answer both of them, okay? So my question, you have my question. If you would answer that one first, and then I'm going to ask a follow-up.
Yes, sir, Representative Steinberg. I am acutely aware of morale being one of the issues that we deal with in prisons. There are many, due to the many complex issues that we have outlined here, it is evident that morale would be a natural byproduct of some of that. And those are issues of what individuals feel that they're paid, what their value, what they're worth. There is no question in my mind, as we have outlined, that we need to provide additional management training. Our people in our facilities have to be better managers all across the system. I, as an individual who spent my career in law enforcement, believe that we should be constantly in a state of evaluation. So we look at morale. We look at the issues that lend itself to low morale. Certainly assaults and deaths of your coworkers will certainly undermine morale. It has undermined my morale as well, but it has not undermined my resolve.
You have a follow-up?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You've heard the expression, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Have you heard that before advertised? I mean, you can just nod your head. That's okay.
Yes, sir.
I think we're all familiar with that. Well, many of these folks who have reached out to me have done so with great fear and intrepidation because of retaliation. They feel there will be retaliation. They've seen retaliation in the past, and that's not a good thing. I mean, we want people to be able to come out and speak those things they can talk about. I understand there's some things they can't, but when they see something wrong within the prison system, and they want to go out and talk to people on the outside, talk to their legislator, they should not be discouraged from doing so. Yet, in letter after letter after letter, which I'd be glad to show you, except I've got to try and keep their names private, people are afraid to do so because of what has happened to some of their colleagues in doing so in the past, that they will be reprimanded in some form or fashion just for speaking out for what they see, the truth. Do you have a problem with them speaking to people on the outside?
No, sir. Just as you have indicated, they have contacted you. And if anybody has concern, I mean, there are many representatives and senators here that I've also spoken directly with about concerns of our personnel, as well as I have spoken with those many individuals all across our system. We have had challenges with communications and email being part of that, but there are avenues of redress that are available to every state employee, and that is not eliminated when somebody goes to work for the Department of Prisons. If somebody has a substantive issue or problem with their supervisor, they have that route through that supervisory review that they can take it up the chain of command. They can reach out to our employee relations through the department. They also have access where they can file complaints or things through our intake, through our internal audit throughout the department as well. We have been trying to be very open and communicate, and I can only account for the larger DPS system since I've been here in 2017 and realizing that they do have a lot of unique challenges. We've been encouraging to them in every venue that I've been at, and I've been very clear because I have heard some of that myself and even encouraged them to the meetings, don't sit there. And it's not because Eric Hooks thinks that he is an individual, is somebody high and mighty, but I do make it clear to them that when I come to meet with you, there's nobody in the department that outranks me. So feel free to speak up, because we want you to speak up.
Right. One more follow-up. Okay.
I have a direct question.
Yes, direct question. All my questions are direct. It just takes me a little longer to get them out. Mr. Secretary, along those lines, you said that the folks understand when they hear you, you're talking to them that this is the way you operate. You want to assure these people that they can move forward and talk and bring forth a complaint or whatever the case might be. How often do you visit the 55 institutions that are under your direction? Do you have a regular pattern, sir, of going into the prisons and visiting with the prisons and talking with the staff and employees of the prison? I think the folks would be interested in knowing that. Thank you.
No, sir, there has not been a particular pattern. As you are well aware, the Department of Public Safety encompasses a large division, which is adult correction. And we have visited facilities, and I began that when I came into office as well as I have been out with emergency management, the National Guard. All of those kind of play a part into that. We have a director of prisons as we had when I came into the facility, and I know the previous chief deputy secretary as well as our current chief deputy secretary visited prisons regularly. And so there is that mechanism for interaction that are there. I can't account for what individuals may have written to you, but I can tell you that some of the same sentiments have been expressed to me, and we have made sure that we open up as many avenues as possible with the realistic expectation that there's no way that I would be able to sit down with each and every employee, but those avenues are open.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Representative Charles Graham, then I have Representative Floyd after Graham.
Thank you, Mr. Hooks, and I want to thank your staff for being here today. I've had an opportunity over the course of the last several years to interact with them and have them come before our committee and share their concerns about DPS and what they do. I have a couple of questions that really jump out, and I'm here to I'm asking these questions because I want to be I'm not. Although I'm a representative, I want to be a stakeholder in what you're doing and trying to help out with the needs. But one of the things that really, in the presentation, jumped out in my mind is the turnover. You're turning over as many people as you're hiring. I got a number here, 147 new hires a month. Then you've got 150 people leaving. What do you think that is?
I think a large part of that is the environment. As I've said, the prisons are a dangerous place. Some people have cited that the pay to work in dangerous places, and I know this body has done a lot of work in the last few years to raise that level of pay, but because of the population that they have to work with day to day, the dangers that they face, and maybe even the lack of recognition that they may receive in the public, all contribute to the turnover rate.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. How much money do we invest to do that officer training, the initial training? How much is invested in those individuals? You know, the number of hours. What kind of financial tag would you put on an individual coming in, getting that training?
Sir, if you allow, I'd would like to defer either to one of our staff members or our chief financial officer to address that. Ms. Stephanie Freeman from the Office of Staff Development and Training.
Thank you, sir. I'm Stephanie Freeman. I'm the director of the Office of Staff Development and Training. Cost of basic training varies. Right now, it is a 160-hour program, so it's 4 weeks. We run many of our schools are commuter schools, so folks travel in and out, so we're not paying per diem. They do receive a salary, so they're receiving their salary and benefits once they're hired and begin training. Some of our academies are overnight. Some of those are at no cost because we're using the Samarkand DPS Training Academy, as well as the North Carolina Justice Academy. We do still have to pay a cost for meals. Other facilities we're using pretty much all over the state. We're using 4-H facilities. We're using forestry training. So you could be looking at anywhere from a high of about $83,000 for 4 weeks. That's a full class of 24 officers, meals and lodging. To a lower cost around $27,000 to $30,000 at some of the other forestry training centers and at the Fort Fisher National Guard down at the coast.
Well, another question.
Follow up.
To the director or?
To the director. Thank you.
Secretary, I'm sorry.
Secretary, it is, sounds like to me it's a pretty expensive endeavor to train these individuals. What is the average stay of an officer, a correction officer?
If you would allow me to recognize our HR director, Sherry Howard, she may have some information to provide to you on that.
My name is Sherry Howard. I'm the HR director for Department of Public Safety. It varies. Our turnover is high in the first 2 years. Of employment. We're trying to make changes in that with some of our, and a lot of that those statistics are before these changes we've made with the basic training. If you'll recall, the basic training before was within the first year.
Mm-hmm.
So we're hoping, we've only recently changed that. We're hoping getting the training at the beginning will change those turnover rates where they're getting trained and not turning over, but we have not been in the new program long enough to have any statistics to show that the training being moved to the very first day of employment, we're hoping will impact that turnover within the first 2 years.
Thank you. And I just have a comment. I'm really concerned about, you know, these are state employees and you have the charge of oversight for 13,000 employees, and then you've got a huge turnover problem. And it is a problem. And I'm hearing in the report that there are many things, and I'd be honest with you, I need to look at this and kind of digest it and consume it a little bit, but there's a great need for improvement within our system. But I see a major concern with your personnel and turnover. You mentioned morale is an issue. I clearly see that it is because you've got as many leaving as you've got coming in. And my next comment is the folks who are coming in, are they, you know, are you just looking for a body?
Well,
you're trying to find warm bodies. I mean, it sounds like to me you've got 147 recruits coming in, and I'm just wondering what is the
Is this a comment or a question?
I'm trying to deal with this, Mr. Chairman.
I've got a whole list.
because I just want your recruiting. I hope you're recruiting good people and people that we're going to invest a lot of money in, and hopefully they'll stay. And that's all for right now, but I do have a lot of – I need to digest this thing a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, I have Representative Floyd, Representative Richardson, Representative Boswell, Senator Randleman, Representative Spashali, Representative Alan McNeil, and Representative Hurley. And Representative Floyd, you have the floor.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to. I have a whole list of questions, so if I can ask some and you go around, will you give me a promise that you'll come back to me?
You go ahead and start at.
Okay. One concern to follow with what Representative Graham has mentioned, and also talking with some Senate employees. They was talking about something as it relates to individual coming to the program, and they stay into the program long enough to draw one paycheck, and the $75,000 is just gone. And they were saying that they need some kind on the top of that that will prevent people from exiting too soon after training. So that's just a suggestion that comes from senior employee, that it would be something to hold them there, not to go through the training for 30 days and then get the paycheck and leave. That's just a suggestion that you look at that. And the other one is that the senior employees mentioned is that falsification of records. And I'm not that familiar with the system, but they're saying that In some instance, if they don't have X person, they will get someone else to sign in, that they do have someone in that slot. That's just a concern, you know, that they have. In some kind of way, if that could be looked at, I don't know, I'm not in that system, but if there's an honest dialogue with members from senior, from my area, I can't speak for other areas, that express those concerns to me. And the other one is about email, and they mentioned that what take place in this system may not be conveyed throughout the system, so they don't know what took place in county and Cumberland County as relates to what happened in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. There need to be some kind of communication that they know that a threat or whatever took place. They just simply need to know. So that's another one. And the other one is, I'm just surprised to hear the presentation when we talk about basic training. And I thought that this is just something that's just standard. But when you say that you are sending officers or individual back through basic training, this is what we get up front, not in the middle of an employment cycle. I think that maybe you didn't say it right, or maybe you didn't express it right. But when you tell me, ex-military person, that someone went back through basic training, I think that you know we might want to use another term, because it's saying that you're wasting a lot of taxpayer dollars by sending an employee who has been there X years or X time back through basic training. But I'm simply here that want to assist you, Mr. Chair, in improving what you're doing. But I do think that I'm the chair, and I'm also you that the next time that the Senate group meet in Fayetteville, that someone will be there, because I don't want them to think that I didn't share their concerns with you. And their number one was the falsification of records.
Well, thank you, Representative Floyd. You're a great representative from Cumberland County, and I guarantee you that somebody will probably be there, but you're going to have to remind them. Thank you. Representative Richardson from Cumberland.
Two questions. In your report, you said that you ordered stab-resistant shirts and you purchased batons. Are these items now in the hands or being worn by the by the guards.
Well, sir, I'll defer to Director Lassiter. He can give you an update on the deployment of those things for our correctional officers.
Kenneth Lassiter, Director of Prisons, and this first statement probably will get me in trouble, but we was talking about morale, and the use of the word guard for a correctional professional tears down their morale. So the correctional officers do have the batons in medium custody. The stab-resistant vest is a major purchase. The purchase order has been cut, and we're waiting on a vendor.
It won't get you in trouble. I apologize.
Second follow-up
question. One of the things that really jumped out when you look at these statistics, and I think one of the causes of the problem, is that the nature of the inmate has changed in the last 6 years substantially. That it's gotten a lot more serious offender that we're actually housing in the correctional facilities. What are you doing to change the programming and the security to match the type of inmate that you're now presently housing?
Yes, sir. That's a very good assessment and question that follows up with that. Specifically with correctional enterprises, when we remove those over 250, which is about 10% of that workforce that kind of fit that more violent type inmate, we have started addressing what are the assessment tools for that. And I just think that the department is developing and working with external stakeholders to develop better assessment tools to see who's most situated for certain type jobs. We do that with, on jobs outset or external people on, I don't want to say work release, but for lack of a better term, that is being done. And so we're looking at enhancing those assessment tools to make determinations as to who has those particular jobs. In the state of North Carolina, has been a longstanding, public policy stance that inmates should not just be sitting around idle. They need to be working. And so within the division and in prisons, they need to make better assessments as to which job programs that they're eligible for.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
One more. How come our guards, our correctional officers, did not have batons and the protective vest before now?
The information that I received since coming to the department as a whole in 2017 has just been financial. Those have been tough financial decisions that have been made based on the structural deficit in which this division operates on. We have been trying to mitigate some of those financial holes by moving money from other areas to address those. And so we have outfitted at least to medium custody with batons, and we're looking forward to other opportunities to leverage assets that we have.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I have Representative Boswell and Senator Randleman. Representative Boswell.
Thank you, sir. First of all, I want to tell you thank you for your presentation. You answered a lot of my questions, and of course, there's still ongoing questions. I think you'll be happy to know that I visited the Hyde County Correctional Institute, and I was patted down like everybody else. They did a great job. I do have a question and concern about the camera situation. They have zero cameras at Hyde County, and I was wondering if that would prioritize them to be first in line to get the new cameras.
Thank you, Representative. So that I don't give you erroneous information, I'm going to make sure that Director Lassiter gives you most direct info.
Kenneth Lassiter, we were able to secure, I think, $1.5 million. Correct me if I'm wrong, recently, and Hyde is number two on that list of facilities needing to be getting some cameras. One of the follow-up response to the question about what are we doing with the offender is the fact that beginning of the presentation talked about this is a different offender, our and why we didn't have batons in medium custody. The medium custody inmate today is not the medium custody inmate of 9 or 10 years ago, and our medium custody inmates at the time were not violent. Our numbers and spikes in the numbers, and we've came in this room and presented and talked about restrictive housing for several years and what was going on and where the violence was. It was not in medium custody until the recent years. And so that's why medium, in using a security funds the appropriate manner, they was diverted to close custody, because at that time, that's where all the assaults were taking place.
Yeah, a follow-up.
Yes, sir. Also, as I was being patted down, I was curious as why there were no drug dogs available to not just for us, but for the workers that are there as well.
Mr. Lassiter.
Kenneth Lassiter. We do have canines for narcotics, for telephones, also for tobacco. We just have a reduced number, so they are deployed throughout the state to all 55 prisons doing targeted searches when we have intelligence. But we do have canines assigned to each region. We're divided into four regions, so each region has canines deployed in those regions.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I wish my police department had one. Now, yeah, we have Senator Chairman Randleman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this will follow up with the comments made by Representative Richardson. Because of your vacant positions, you generate large sums of lap salaries. And I know $20 million or somewhere in the $20 million range of those lap salaries goes to cover workman's compensation. So have you reviewed the past uses of lap salary funds? And have you shifted the use of those funds to cover some of the one-time expenditures for the needs of the staff safety and equipment uses?
Yes, ma'am. The short answer to that is yes. We're in a constant state of evaluation of where we can leverage our dollars, and a large part of that is lap salary. I'm very fortunate in our organization to have Darlene Langston as our budget director and Doug Holbrook as our chief financial officer, and they're well in tune to how to manage the money, as evidenced by auditing principles that have that they have gone through. And so I could defer to either one of them about the specifics, ma'am.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Okay. So on slide 10, you've already made reference to the stab-resistant shirts for the 13 certified employees. You've also talked about the long-range strategic plan for video camera upgrades and the needs for cameras and the developing of the personal body alarm technology and the radio device upgrades. So have we used any of our current lap salaries to start addressing some of these needs?
Yes, ma'am, and if you would allow me to recognize our Chief Financial Officer, Doug Holbrook, to address that more specifically.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members. Yes, for those three items.
Please state your name, please.
I'm Doug Holbrook, Chief Financial Officer of the Department of Public Safety.
Thank you.
As far as the stab-resistant shirts, we have put those on order. That is a $3.6 million purchase. We have that amount of money, of course, in our uniform budget, which has not run dry yet. As ongoing expenses occur, we will need to refill that with lap salary as the year progresses, but we did have a sufficient balance in there to go ahead and make that order, which will be coming in slowly. That's a lot of shirts to buy from one manufacturer. We have had a long-term plan for replacing all of our surveillance cameras, and we have a small amount of money that we can go through that. We have not used any lap salary for that yet. But we have been able to get $1.5 million from the state budget office. They canceled an R&R project in another part of state government, and they freed up R&R money and offered us $1.5 million, and we have applied that to begin the camera upgrade process. So we will have better surveillance cameras. It still takes time to deploy them because we have to install them, and we only have our internal staff at this point to do that. So no lap salary has been used on cameras yet. And as far as the body alarm technology and the lanyards, we have not ordered lanyards yet. We have not designated that. We do have a worksheet, too, for an expansion budget item for that. The body alarm technology and the lanyards and so forth is fairly substantial. $12.5 million for the purchase of the equipment, because it requires a lot of networking within the prison so that we get the two-way communications on our existing radio network, and also for the purchase of that number, I believe 15,000 lanyards for everyone to have, including visitors.
Thank you, Mr. Holbrook. And can the department update this committee and the appropriation chairs as lap salaries are used to cover some of these expenditures? Because I know there's going to be some requests of the Appropriations Committee.
Absolutely.
And if you are using lap salary, then we would like to know what those uses are for.
Yes, ma'am. I will point out we do generate quite a lot, and it is what we have experienced over the last 5 years is a decline in the amount of lapsed salary that we still have left at the end of the year, because much of it goes into officer overtime and inmate medical, which have been, you know, substantially climbing over the past couple of years. 5 years ago, we were reverting over $60 million at the end of the fiscal year. This past year, it was less than $6 million was left over out of our $2 billion.
Thank you. And Representative Bashala, you pass? Okay. We have Representative Alan McNeil, Representative Hurley, Senator Daniels, and then I have Representative Floyd again. Representative McNeil, you have the floor from Randolph.
Thank you. Just a couple questions. I appreciate your presentation, Mr. Secretary, and maybe the National Institute of Corrections report that you're going to release later will maybe answer this question. I don't know. North Carolina is not an island when it comes to recruiting prison guards. As I understand, there's a national trend in recruiting prison guards and recruiting highway patrolmen. Anybody going into law enforcement is having trouble now recruiting people. Have you looked into other states and how they're solving their recruitment problem? And maybe that information is in the national report that you're going to give us later, but are there some states that are having success, and are we looking at those, and maybe could we copy what they're doing?
Yes, sir. I think probably more appropriate than the NIC report is the GCC report, where they delve into that and they've networked and canvassed other states about what they have done to enhance and their recruitment efforts and to deal with retention. So in that GCC report that was published, released to us in December the 7th and then transmitted publicly on December the 8th, there are certain recommendations in there. And we are looking at that across the department, and our HR is evaluating that as well as the division about how to improve, enhance our recruitment, and to retain our employees. So it would be the GCC report that will probably provide some additional external guidance to you on that.
All right. Thank you for that answer. And now my next one is maybe one that you don't have the information on, or maybe you do. Actually, it's kind of two questions. The first one is, until 2017, which was a horrible year with the five deaths that you're talking about. But prior to that, I don't think there had been a death in the prison system in North Carolina due to an assault in the last 10 years. So what happened in 2017? What changed all of a sudden? For this to happen in our prisons in 2017, and then that question, and then another question is, and I appreciate the fact of the statement that you're going to start charging inmates with sexual assault if they do these things, but you're having trouble already prosecuting prisoners who assault guards. The cases are not being adjudicated, being dismissed. What about the just charging more inmates with crimes is not going to solve a problem if they're not prosecuted?
Mr. Secretary, I'm going to invoke chairmanship.
Yes, sir.
I know Mr. Lasseter has probably been in the prison system longer than anybody around here, and I know he talked about the difference of the inmates today versus the inmates of yesteryear, and that there hasn't been a death. If you just like to review that again as firsthand to Representative McNeil.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. It was over 30 years since a correction officer had been killed by an inmate in our state. Unfortunately, this past year, five of our colleagues won't return home to their family following their duty. The change has been a systemic change, some affected by laws. When we start to sentence people to greater sentences,
to a environment that has more mental health inmates than it do people not on mental health treatment, and resources being applied to take care of the sick people that need to be taken care of but probably shouldn't be in prison, intertwined with some very mean people. So that's part of it. Some have said, and the conversation has been around morale and vacancies and turnovers, that wouldn't play a role in the murder itself, but it makes the environment more conducive for someone who's evil to be brave. And so our staff vacancies not directly contributing, but it may empower someone to think that there's not a response. It's just their opinion. Prisons are designed to separate those that society say need to be incarcerated for the crimes they have committed. Justice reinvestment, the change in structured sentencing, is putting people behind bars that are meaner. They're more aggressive. And our prison's design, our prison staffing, was not built for these inmates. And so one of the things we're doing, and I think last year we had some studies done about staffing and showed that we were over 13, even with the vacancies, we're 1,300 corrections officers short in what we see and the correctional professionals see would be an adequate number to supervise this caliber of inmate.
Thank you. And just to comment, and this can go out to all the prosecutors in the state. You know, if a prisoner knows that he's not going to get prosecuted for assaulting the guard, he's going to assault the guard. If you know, put him in the hole for 30 days, I mean, you know, he may get his attention, but unless he's prosecuted and that sentence is fully adjudicated and he gets some more time, I think you're just spinning your wheels.
Thank you, Representative Neal. Have Representative Hurley, Senator Daniels, and Representative Floyd. Representative Hurley from Randolph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Secretary, Ms. Cashwell, for being here today. I know you have a serious job, and Representative Faircloth and I have been to one of your prisons to talk to some of the inmates there who had written us, and of course somebody was with us all the time, so it was difficult for them to talk to us, to be open. I don't know if there's anything to do about that. We need somebody with us when we're there. Also, I've been into the Nash County, one of the Nash Correctional Center and the Randolph Correctional Center. I think it's important that we do know what we're overseeing here. My question is, when you mention lanyards, and the first thing popped into my mind, they go around your neck, unless it's a different kind of lanyard. Is that the kind of lanyard you're talking about hiring? Having? Buying? Oh. Yeah. Don't get them around the neck. Please.
Hold on. We're going to let the CFO here speak. If you identify yourself, please.
Doug Holbrook with the Department of Public Safety. There are two varieties that they can be around the neck or as part of the belt, the security belt that the correctional officer has issued. But everyone entering the prison will need to have one of these, not just those who are sworn. So if you go again to visit a prison, it is our intent, and obviously that's not going to happen this month, but it is our intent that you would be given a lanyard to wear yourself while you're being accompanied. So anybody in any situation inside a prison is going to have some means of communication. We're not likely to have, you know, you're not likely to have the kind of belt, so yours probably would be sort of the life alert kind of around the neck thing for the visitors.
I know, but okay. All right. My next question. In recruiting, and I know it's difficult to recruit because they are in danger all the time, because you never know what an inmate's going to do. I know they've had to have a college degree, to be able to get the job for some of these jobs. If you've got somebody that has an awful lot of experience in security and in knowing what to do in the jails or wherever, but they don't have a degree, could this policy be changed at all so that these people could be looked at?
Well, I'll defer to our HR professional.
Sherry Howard, HR director. We don't require them to have a degree. They only have to have high school, 20 years of age, and be a U.S. citizen to meet the minimum qualifications. And then, of course, they have to follow the CJ standards of, you know, passing drug screening. But as far as qualifications, they do not have to have a four-year degree or a degree. It can be high school. I think that was your question.
It was. I was under the wrong impression, and maybe I'm thinking about probation, parole. But I think they still need to be, yeah, opportunity there for going up. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hurley. Have Senator Daniels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Secretary, and your staff for your presentation. And a lot of the, you know, I have, I think, three or four prisons in my district, and so I hear a lot of the comments that are similar to what Representative Steinberg has mentioned, and just, you know, different suggestions about how to make the prisons better. And it sounded like from your presentation that some of those are consistent with what I've heard in my district. I guess one thing I wanted to touch on is and your HR person may need to address this, but in the area of turnover, one of the things I've heard in my district from correctional employees is that there's one of the problems is that there's a lot of turnover in the early months of employment, and they attribute that to two things. One is that they have observed they don't feel like the sort of the initial orientation when you bring in a prospective employee, they sort of don't give them a full picture of what this job is going to look like, you know, sort of behind the door, behind the bars. And secondly, that they didn't feel like the basic training is adequate. And so by the time they're put into a correctional officer position behind the bars, there's sort of an early, I didn't know what I was getting myself into type moment. And then they say, I think I'd rather do something else. And so I guess I maybe wanted to ask you, does the turnover statistics bear that out, that a lot of the turnover is, say, within the first, you know, 18 months of employment, from your experience?
I will defer to our HR director concerning as to when that turnover, does take place. I would like to comment prior to that is that basic officer training is just that, basic officer training. Having somebody that went through basic law enforcement training in the 1980s, it was just that. It gave me the foundation to grow and develop as an agent, but I had a field training officer in the SBI to bring me along, just like we have in the Highway Patrol, and that's what we are trying to instill with corrections now, that we go to that field training officer program, somebody that can mentor, nurture, and encourage those people as they walk into that dangerous environment. It's no different, as we talked about, through the military, and I know that there are a number of folks that you all have honorably served, as well as our general here, is that provides you that basic foundation, but then there's so much more that's needed. We don't have those abilities to retain them like the military does if somebody decides one day, I don't want to do this. However, those are things that we need to really implement and move corrections toward as well, so we can mentor those people so that people are coming here for a career, not just a job, not just a stopover, not for just that one check. But there are always going to be individuals that get in here in any profession, law enforcement profession. And this goes back to Representative McNeil's comments, too. All across law enforcement, we're having difficulty attracting people to the business. It's an honorable profession and one that I care deeply passionate about, but we have seen difficulties in recruiting for the Highway Patrol, SBI, ALE. And so it's not just unique to prisons, but it is exacerbated by the conditions by which they work in and our total vacancy rate.
Okay. Senator Daniel, do you have a follow-up? Or
I guess I wanted to see if Ms. Howard had any statistics that confirmed or denied.
Will you repeat the question again?
I guess the question is your turnover more heavily weighted towards the first 18 months of employment as opposed to more senior employees?
Our statistics on that, when we look at turnover, we look at whole years, 2016. For those years before we implemented a lot of our current changes, there was approximately about 49% of our turnover was happening within the first 24 months. And the reasons varied, better employment, funding, money, training, lack of, delayed training since those statistics. We have put some things in place to hopefully change those statistics. One of those was moving basic training, to the beginning of their employment so that they don't start work without the basic training. So we're hoping that does turn those statistics. Also in March, I think you heard earlier that we're implementing a field training officers program. Those people will be partnered like mentors with these people within those first 24 months. We're projecting approximately about 600 people located throughout the state in the facilities to partner with these new employees as a mentor, making sure they get the training, that they're available to help them with any situational awareness, policy questions. So we're hoping that also impacts that number. And of course, we have, since those statistics, given some increases in pay. And I can say the correctional officers, when we went out and about, were very appreciative to you, the legislature, for recognizing their pay. They were very appreciative, but they always say we would like to have more. So we're hoping these things that we've been putting into place within the last year are going to impact those turnover rates positively. But as I said, it takes time of all those things happening over time. We've not made those changes for a long enough period of time yet to see if they're going to make that number go down. So we'll be closely monitoring that over the next year and continuing to do exit interviews with employees as they leave to make sure the reasons why they're leaving, that we're addressing those issues.
Thank you.
I have Representative Floyd for a follow-up. I have Senator Randleman and Representative Graham for second time.
Yeah, one of the questions. So that's the one concerning the badge, is the identification badge. And that would go around the neck and wear on the side. That's been there. But I'm concerned, I think the gentleman mentioned that you have 1,300 vacancies today. What's 1,300?
And Representative Floyd, if I could have, yes. Senator Randleman was going to make a comment, both Appropriation Chair and Chair. Senator Randleman, you recognize at this time?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question would be for Secretary Hooks, because in one of our update conversations, we talked about staffing. And I ask you if we had adequately staffed you, and your response was yes, under the current staffing model. And then we got into how that was pre-structured sentencing, and that post-structured sentencing, that you had recently done an assessment, or maybe last year your department had done an assessment on post-structured sentencing and how that had changed the inmates and the security level of the inmates that you currently house. And you at that time had expressed to the chairs that you had a proposal possibly during the 2017 long session, but that was not presented to the General Assembly. So until we had that conversation, we did not know the difference between your pre-structured sentencing staffing and your post-structured sentencing staffing. But the 1,300 is per the new assessment for post-structured sentencing staffing. Is that correct?
To the best of my understanding, yes, ma'am. It's been a learning process. When people ask about are you currently staffed adequately, it's based on approximate time period. And so what is recognized, and what I am saying is that we have to go through that evaluation to look toward the future. What is the new need?
Mr. Secretary, you've got a great staff, and they're all going like this. So I'm going to let them.
Mr. Lassen.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. The 1,300 that I mentioned is the new staffing number. Last year, we did some workup with our great staff from research and Mr. Coleman's shop, and it showed, and this was looking at national trends across the country, looking at
where we were standing in reference to what type of individual was in prison. And we came, I think the number that's rounded it off is around 1,300 additional correctional officers would be the ideal number to make a much safer environment for our staff.
A follow-up, please.
Yes.
So if we can't fill the positions we have now, what are we going to do to fill the additional 1,300 positions?
I must say that they're going to throw it back on you now.
No, I was saying last year.
And that is a very good question, madam. It comes up frequently in reference to one of the disadvantages we have with having 55 prisons is that some of them have built in pockets that there is no employment pool. That's just a reality. And so trying to figure out what's best to do with those facilities to maintain them, but which caliber inmate, it may be reducing the custody level at those facilities where it requires fewer officers and then changing some other sites, you know, down the line. But the poor number of needing those numbers and us doing a better effort of retention, not just recruitment, but retaining staff, it will build on us being able to keep those people around. That 1,300 number, though, is needed.
Thank you. Representative Floyd, you have a follow-up?
Well, since that question has been answered, on July 1, how many vacancies did the department have? That's question one.
I don't have that number readily available to me, sir, but we can certainly research that and have that provided to you.
Sure. Question two is on December the 31st, 6 months after the budget has been approved and you have been operating on, how many as of December the 31st? I know you couldn't answer the first one, so you can't answer the second. But as a rule of thumb, it's really something that the finance person can begin to look at, because that money is there. And if you look at one-time purchasing, that is the best time to look at that and get with the finance chairs or budget chairs to let them know that this is what we want to engross here, so in that we could begin to move forward on purchases that may take 4, 5, or 6 months. Because if not, I'm not a finance person, don't know, can't even count my own money. But I do know that I do believe that if it's not used, it convert back to general funds. Is that
they use it?
But what I'm saying is this. If they don't use it and don't have it appropriated and don't have it earmarked, then it goes back to general operation.
Nicole uses it. Thank you, Representative Flo.
Senator Randall, and you want to?
Yeah. Thank you. I have, for the first time, Senator Barringer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Secretary Hooks, for such a good and thorough presentation. I have two lines of questions, unrelated but related to this topic. My first question is that in most state agencies, we're also facing a retirement crisis. Our employees are aging, and I would like to know how that's going to affect the other end of the service with respect to retirements. What's the anticipated retirement rate that's coming up?
Well, I believe Chief Deputy Cashwell gave the number that we are facing that primarily with at the superintendent's or management level, and so we have that need to groom new talent coming up. We oftentimes talk about a deficit of money, but there's going to be, and that is the case in some places across North Carolina, a deficit of experience. And so that it's hard to quantify that, but it will create additional difficulties for us.
And follow up. So with respect to the correction officers, the ones that are right there on the ground with the inmates, are you not anticipating that it would really be in the higher level of management?
Mr. Lassiter may be able to give a more definitive answer concerning retirement outlook for our baseline correctional officers.
It's pretty much in line with the managers, a little bit behind the members percentage with the managers, because in 1977 through 82 was a big deal for us.
in North Carolina when it came to correction facilities and additions. Those people now are 32, 33-year employees, so they're leaving. So, yes, ma'am, it will be a percentage of COs that's caught up in the number that is going as well.
And thank you. And then a follow-up in a different vein. My background is not in corrections, so I'm trying to be a quick study. Can you explain to me why the structured sentencing has had such an effect on your prison population? I certainly understand the mental health issues. I certainly understand the nature of that population as far as there. I believe you said that they were just plain mean people. But what does the structured sentencing do? Why is that so impactful?
All right. Senator, if you...
And I'd also, Doug would also speak about when you mentioned the 70s, that's when the prisons were built also, which was a different model than what we need today. And so we're behind.
Yes, sir. I'm Doug Holbrook with Public Safety. The history on the structured sentencing, which I was on staff at the Sentencing Commission at that time when they originally designed structured sentencing. Back then, North Carolina had a prison population cap. We were having cycling people in and out of prison at much short of their sentence length. So the decision was made. We were going to build new resources, but we wanted to put reserve prison capacity for only the most dangerous, most violent people, not for statusy offenders, but rather ones who were a danger. And so that was the intent. Before then, judges could kind of choose. They just thought a misdemeanor was a bad kid and just needed to be jerked up, I guess. Well, structured sentencing tried to prevent that. And so the intent was that you would have people who committed violent crimes or who were habitual offenders would be getting the prison spaces, and you would not be sending other kinds of offenders to prison. So in order to contain the population, so that was the purpose, was to keep it from growing, keep it from becoming a booming business for the state, and also bearing in mind that it was going to be limiting it to a mostly dangerous, violent, habitual offender population. And just as an example of that, when judges had more discretion, one of the biggest concerns was the female population, which had always been very small, but without judicial discretion, female offenders would be much more likely to be going to prison than had previously been the case. This is just as an example. And so back then, we had to look very closely at female prison resources because we just hadn't had to pay close attention before.
Any comment on it?
Doug did it well.
Okay, good. Okay. Thank you. We have Representative Faircloth for the first time, and then I have Representative Graham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Interesting presentation. A lot for us to think about and a lot of us for us to chew on. I would ask for questions in two areas. First of all, I hope I did not gather in the early discussion we had that justice reinvestment was the wrong move for us to make. That I didn't hear that, did I?
No, sir.
Because I think we may have learned a lot and probably need to make some changes, but I think that was a major move forward in our state. I'm glad you're nodding that way.
Yes.
The second question I have, we're going through an unbelievable change in our society now, with moving from where we were 5 years ago. Technologically, we're years ahead of where we thought we'd be. And in three or four more years, an old hot rodder like me won't even have a car to drive. I'll just sit there and the car will drive itself. So is there a possibility that if we take a good hard look at architecture of prisons, and technology as it relates to manning those prisons, Is there fertile ground out there for us to perhaps find something that will help us make some of the moves we want to make?
Yes, sir. I think it would be to North Carolina's benefit that we take a forward-looking view toward that, because actually, a lot of the issues that we face are dealing with antiquated structures of our facilities. We haven't dug deep into that today because that is a tremendous financial investment, but that is something that does need to be married together, the use of technology. You know, we can't replace the investments that we need to make in our individual employees, but we do need to leverage our technology and our architecture for our facilities to help manage this new population better into the future.
Okay. Representative Charles Graham from Robinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple. Thank you. I have a couple questions. One, my first question, I guess, would be to Mr. Lassiter. You mentioned mental health earlier, and I think you may have said that something to the effect that maybe 50% of your population are coming in with mental health diagnoses or have mental health issues. Was it that much? What was that? How much? What's the percentage?
We can dig that the exact numbers out, but my statement was in reference to the diagnosis of mental health was not in anybody's evaluation or equation of where we were going and how we got to 2017. The mental health population is just booming with us, and they're staying with us a lot longer time and have some serious mental health concerns.
Thank you, and I want to follow up on that.
Representative, if you'll hold a minute, please. I think the Secretary has somebody that...
Sir, if you would allow me to recognize Deputy Secretary Joe Prater, they can speak to that as well.
Thank you. Joe Prater, Deputy Secretary, Department of Public Safety. Mental health and the diagnosis of that within prisons, as we've described, is a major player in our new day. What we're seeing now is that there's been a 65% increase over the last 10 years of those that would be diagnosed and or treated with a mental illness based on certain criteria we use. And that criteria we could get into some detail about, but it's just kind of a threshold that's set. Currently, we establish that overall population of those that might be diagnosed that way, it's somewhere around 17-18% of the total population right now.
And I follow up. Are those, that 17-18%, are they embedded with these A through E felons?
They are one. Some of them are the A through E felons.
So, follow up. So, we have A through E felons who have severe mental health issues. Then my question now is, are they being addressed?
The answer would be yes. We have a great mental health system. Okay. We are probably on the forefront. This body built the facility at Central Prison some years ago. This body invested and the therapeutic diversion units a couple of years back, and they are paying dividends. Do we have enough to address an 18% of 36,500 average population? No. We've asked in the past for some additional resources to address this population, but that number keeps growing.
Thank you. And my last question. How does North Carolina, and this would be to Secretary Hooks, how does North Carolina rate nationwide, if you have that information, pay comparison to other states for correction officers?
Well, to give you the most appropriate answer, let me turn you over to one of our staff members. There are some numbers that have been out there is that we actually compare more favorably in the Southeast, but nationally we fall lower on the scale. And so it just depends on who you hear from at the time. I don't have that national number or that regional number right here for this presentation because we weren't specifically addressing specific dollar amounts, but we could get that information to you directly, sir.
Thank you. Any other, that goes through the list, any other chamber would like to have a question?
Chairs? Staff, y'all have a question? Okay. Once again, I was going to have... Okay, I'm sorry.
No, Chair. I just thought, Mr. Chairman, perhaps we could see where we're going to go from here. You know, I don't want to see this drop through the cracks. Excellent presentation. I appreciate you being here and taking the questions and providing the answers. But once again, where do we go from here?
Where we go to from here, this is just the beginning. They're going to evaluate the NIC. They will be getting back with the chairs and with this committee. Recommendations. They have also are having recommendations for the appropriations that's coming up in May, and it will be an ongoing dialogue between the chairs, this committee, and with the secretary. At this point in time, I'd like to recognize John Petit again to give the website where people can write comments, and he will give you directions. And John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, it's on the Justice and Public Safety Oversight Committee website. There's a link there called Request for Comments. The comments will then be bundled and sent to the members on a daily basis as they come in. If you have any problems getting that or any problems accessing that, please contact one of us on staff, and we'll follow up with the information services folks to make sure you're all getting that. But that's for the public and other folks to make comments to you all, and you all can have and receive their feedback.
Thank you. At this time, I recognize Secretary Hooks one more. Thank you. We'd like to acknowledge the great staff that is here with him. I never saw them go like this when he was going like this. So they're Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, sir. I would like to recognize, so that you will know who the members of that have been pitching in with many others in this. Of course, you have heard from Chief Deputy Secretary Cashwell, who is up here, Chief Deputy Cassandra Hookstra, our Director of Prisons, Kenneth Lassiter, our General Counsel, Jane Gilchrist. You have the esteemed Adjutant General, General Lusk here. Director Schirmeyer has come here to support us, even though we certainly know they operate independent, but we do support them in administrative and financial means. Our Chief Financial Officer, Doug Holbrook, our HR Director, Sherry Howard, Joe Prater, who you heard from, is the Deputy Secretary in the Division of Adult Corrections and Juvenile Justice. We have Deputy Secretary Tim Moose from the Department of from the Division of Adult Corrections and Juvenile Justice, who gives leadership to community corrections. We have joining back to our department from OSBM, who's worked very collaboratively with your staff here too, with physical research, Tracy Little, who's joining us as a special assistant to the Chief Deputy Secretary's Office for Adult Corrections. You heard from Director of OSDT, Stephanie Freeman, who provides leadership to that organization. We brought over Mike Daniska, who is the Director of Research and Planning for the department. He previously served in that role with emergency management, and we wanted to leverage his talents across the department as well. And I made reference to our budget director, Darlene Langston, who's been invaluable to us. And then I'm sure many and most all of you know Deputy Secretary Billy Lassiter, who gives direction to our juvenile justice.
All right, now I want to recognize one other person, because we have to go through him before we can get to you. Andy? That's your legislative, and I think there's others back there, legislative assistants, I mean not legislative assistants, legislative liaisons, is that if you have any questions in either chamber, these are the three that you really need to go through, and they'll get you answers. So, Representative Spashali.
Is there a roster available of who everybody is, including the liaisons?
They should have been by your office and give you a business card. Representative Graham.
I just want to vouch for what you said. Those legislative liaisons, especially Mr. Andy Brandon, who I worked with in the past, is right on top of the job, and I commend them as well.
They are. And this time, staff, John Petit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to point out that Representative Spashali will get the contact information for you of the people who are named.
Yeah, and Nicole Sullivan had left, and I learned a lot with cognitive behavior with Nicole throughout the years, and she evaluates me every time we talk about my actions. She's a great asset we have. With no further comments or questions, the committee is adjourned, and thank you. Thank you.